the court will come to order for this recommencement of the inquest into the death of Keren Ellen Rowland on this October 1st, 1971 at 11:30 a.m. Coroner Kevin Dobson presiding.
Be seated. I do not intend to go into the evidence at any great length. It is still fresh in our memories, the girl's pregnancy, her engagement to marry, the subsequent breaking of that engagement, the breakdown in her health that followed, the subsequent admission to and discharge from M ward of the Canberra Hospital. We have heard of her occupation at the Prosser swimming pool. We have evidence of her meeting her sister in Civic with the intention of going to the Statesman Hotel with her sister and two male companions, that their plans were changed, the intention then to go to a hotel on the northern side of the lake. Following the other car, the deceased vehicle dropped back after rounding Rondpond. The first car then proceeded to the Rowlands home, and the deceased car was later found abandoned in Parks Way, approximately midway between Kings Avenue and Anzac Parade. The vehicle was locked and found to be out of petrol. A girl was seen by several people walking towards Civic. Undoubtedly, this was the deceased, and from the last such sightings until her skeletal remains were found on May 13, 1971, there is an absolute blank. We have evidence of subsequent searches conducted by the police, interstate and ACT, the relatives and other persons between the period 26 February and 13th of May 1971, evidence of a woman having been heard to scream in nearby areas of New South Wales. We have been told of the finding of the body, the position, the clothing, the position of shoes, biro pen and handbag, all in the near vicinity of the body. From here on, we ask questions which cannot be answered, starting with why did the deceased car run out of petrol in view of the fact on the previous day the petrol gauge was showing full. From the mileage we have been told was covered, I could not expect that the petrol tank be empty when the vehicle was found. The next question, how did the deceased get from where she left the car to where she was eventually found? At this stage, of course, it is imperative to mention the sighting of another car in the near vicinity of the deceased car, the identification of which and the driver of which both still remain unknown. I feel I am justified in connecting her movements from there on with this particular vehicle, but the very vital information with respect to this has not been forthcoming, despite numerous checks of motor vehicles carried out in both the ACT and interstate. From the autopsy, the only positive finding was the pinkish discoloration of the lower thirds of the teeth. I feel that all of us who have been connected with the inquest have in mind as the cause of death as either one, suicide, two, abortion, or three, murder or other similar foul play. On one occasion only during the course of her pregnancy did the deceased ever mention taking her own life. There is nothing at all in her behaviour or temperament on the day of her disappearance to suggest that she intended doing away with herself. Suicide from barbiturate tablets must be considered in view of the pink teeth discoloration. No tablets were found. There was no trace of barbiturates found in her skeletal remains or on the ground thereunder. And there is no evidence, as far as I can see, that any such tablets were ever prescribed. Even the position in which the body was found suggests that she did not accept this position voluntarily. In short, although suicide cannot be discounted, it finds very little support from me on the evidence before me. With respect to abortion, likewise, this cannot be ruled out, but there is not one tittle of evidence that any arrangement had ever been made, and at such a relatively late stage of pregnancy, would be beset with the utmost danger. It is also common knowledge that abortion, whether carried out by a medical practitioner or a backyard abortionist, carries a substantial fee. There is no evidence that any such fee has ever been paid. The absence of any fetal remains within the body may in itself suggest abortion. Indeed, it is the only thing that does suggest it, but I feel this absence is fully explained by the evidence of Dr. Thompson and Dr. Isaac. None of her associates could recall her mentioning abortion. And all told, I can find nothing to suggest an abortion had been carried out, but again, of course, it cannot be ruled out completely. This leaves us with murder or foul play of one kind or another. There was no evidence except for the possibility of strangulation. All the bones were accounted for, apart from the small left spur of the hyoid bone from the neck region. Considering all the evidence, my mind tends before death by murder or foul play of some kind. At the same time, the evidence is not strong enough to support such a finding, and I am forced to bring in an open verdict.
That, a recreation of Coroner Kevin Dobson's summation at the conclusion of the coronial inquest into Kerrin's death. His findings, or lack thereof, were handed down after just over a day. With means, method, and motive still cryptically clouded, yet a further compelling development had emerged.
Whether it was strangulation or not, there is a very strong suggestion from the evidence that the body had been in fact dragged to the position in which it was found.
I'm Nicole Overall, award-winning journalist, author, and social historian, and this is Capital Crime Files, exploring the unsolved, unexplained, and unknown at the heart of a nation. Episode 5, Exhibit Q, has been researched, written, and produced by me following numerous interviews, the sourcing of first-hand accounts, obtaining archival material including the official inquest, and more. For additional information, references, media and links, see capitalcrimefiles.com.au. In the following, some names have been omitted or changed in the interest of privacy or to avoid prejudicing a trial should one eventuate. The body was lying on its back, legs together, with the feet towards the track and the head into the plantation. The ground fell away between the feet and the head, resulting in the head being lower than the feet. Sergeant 3rd Class Philip Baer of the Scientific Section of the ACT Police, in his description of the sight that greeted them in that oppressive forest on that May day. 6 years charged with duties extending to the initial examination of crime scenes and exhibits therefrom. Carving a divide between two dense stands of innumerable Pinus radiata softwoods, the rough red dirt track, itself winding off about 50 feet, or 15 metres, from where the body lay. In the intervening and open expanse, at intervals, estimations of which varied, a veritable signposting of something seriously amiss. A right sandal, pen, a handbag, a torn fragment of pantyhose, and most proximate to her feet, the matching left shoe. On a diagram exhibited to the court, incorrectly documented with the name Rollins, small letter X's marking the spots. This A3-sized, apparently scale plan of the scene, in the top right corner, a quarter inch nominated as equating to a foot in real life, reveals the next incongruity. Drawn as little more than six haphazard diagonal lines, beginning near the first two abandoned personal accessories, angling up and to the left, away from the remaining three items. Leading off the dirt road into the area, at an angle of about 10 o'clock analogue style, two longer parallel lines. As described by the dark-haired Sergeant Baer, faint motor vehicle tracks in the grass in the area between the body and the track. While distinct enough to be noticeable, perhaps corresponding to more than 10 feet each in length, the tread marks were deemed too ill-defined for accurate measurement. Neither were they of a level to afford anything that might uncover the make of a vehicle that may have imprinted them. Sergeant Baer was well positioned to make such a call, one of those involved in establishing the forensic capability of the ACT Police commenced from 1952. He was proficient in taking plaster casts of everything from shoe prints to tyre marks. The occurrence and positioning of these, surely more than mere happenstance. Rather, might it be evidence of a car pulling off that track, closer to the darkened line of closely knit trees, Kerrin Rowland pulled from it and discarded like yesterday's rubbish? That trail of belongings, breadcrumbs in a horror story, the telltale remnants of an otherwise ordinary existence. Coroner Dobson twice articulated such a notion.
The disposition of the biro pen, the shoes, the handbag, and the portion of pantyhose as shown on the sketch, which has been tendered, forming, as Detective Sergeant Bayer pointed out, an approximate straight line from the body to the track, the inference being that they came adrift from the person of the deceased as she was dragged headfirst into the position in which she was found. The portion of pantyhose was in good and clean condition, indicating that it had become detached prior to decomposition having commenced or advanced to any great degree.
The autopsy-conducting government pathologist Dr. Thompson would offer more detail. At the back of the lower left leg, the pantyhose were extensively torn, having snagged on a stick. For the doctor, two possibilities. It could have happened if she'd stumbled backwards to fall as she was found, or while she was being hauled over the ground to that spot. The seemingly stronger proof for the second assertion, that the stocking piece was recorded as 14-odd feet from the body. ACT Police Medical Officer Dr. Richard H. Isaac would note just this inconsistency. Her arms extend upwards, encircling her head, the right palm up, slightly higher than the left, it half bent, palm down, post-mortem blackened fingers embedded in the soil and pine needles, her crystal watch face unbroken. For Dr. Isaac, all of this highly suggestive of the body being pulled into the spot through a grip on the forearms or the elbows, either before rigor mortis or after it disappeared around 2 days from death. He'd also articulate how it would apply if the subject was deeply unconscious and death followed without recovery. In a modern-day analysis of the cold case scene, Detective Sergeant Adam Reinhardt of the Australian Federal Police, AFP, Canberra Division, essentially offers agreement on all of this.
Clearly recognise that's the pine plantation. So this is a fairly rudimentary map from the initial investigation. Here it shows where Karen is, and you might see like there's a straight line of personal possessions that Karen was wearing at the time. Reading to that, it would suggest that she was dragged in a fairly straight line from the side of the road or the track into where she was located in the forest. This is demonstrating, there's a gateway there, which you look at original photographs did exist, but demonstrates that straight line of possessions that have been dropped, close proximity, some tyre tracks.
Karen's younger brother Steve, having lived and relived the experience countless times since, has reached a similar conclusion.
Her hands above her head indicate that how she's been pulled out of the car. Her belongings could have fallen from her as she's been manoeuvred to the spot.
Rather than Karen dying at that point, he's more convinced she was most likely dead by the time she was left there. Might the end have come while she was in the car at the location? Or somewhere else, perhaps even much later, the body dumped thereafter? This latter prospect gained a degree of traction with an inability to pinpoint exact timing. How long dead, it was asked. The skeleton was slightly greasy to the touch. This occurs on the breaking down of soft tissue in moister conditions. Karen was left to the elements for the tail end of a summer of heavy rain, alternating with hot, dry weather, through an autumn that, according to the Bureau of Meteorology, was drier and colder than average. While high temperatures can accelerate the process of decomposition, it slows in moist or wet environments. Natural mummification can be a consequence of drier conditions and if remains are exposed to intense sunlight. The nearest Dr. Isaac could ascertain, the window was not less than 8 to 9 weeks since death, but not longer than 3 months. The May 13 revelation of Karen's whereabouts, almost precisely 11 weeks from the time she went missing. Blades of grass foreign to the immediate area were commented upon as possibly indicative of the body moved after death. Later suggested to be the same as that which had been blowing from the adjacent paddocks on the day the remains were found. These potential origin points were not specifically designated, nor how far away they were. Dr. Isaac would also declare that the soil beneath the body was consistent with the corpse having been in situ throughout decomposition. Sergeant Reinhardt is not of the belief there was any pronounced delay between Karen's death and her abandonment in the isolated locale.
I think the suggestion that she was put there as a later date, I don't think that carries much weight at all.
Potentially corroborating this, Karen's final placement intended to make discovery difficult, though clearly not impossible. Only a few metres deeper, and her ultimate fate may have remained a forever mystery. The detective again.
One thing about the crime scene is Karen's body was found only a short distance from a track. In fact, so close the lady was walking on that morning, could see her pretty easily. So the crime scene itself, but certainly not too much effort was made to hide that Karen was actually there.
Back in 1971, references were made to pine needles scattered over much of the remains, perhaps drifting naturally from the boughs above, perhaps strategically positioned. Dr. Isaac's statement highlighted four lopped branches, dry and brittle, and denuded of any leaf or pine needles. These were positioned about 3 feet to the right of and beyond a tree. In the space between that pine and these bare branches, the badly decomposed corpse. In later press reports, it would be reiterated that the body was found with pine debris and branches around it, rather than covering it. With no attempt to retrieve the personal belongings, could it all be suggestive of a hurried, panicked act to be rid of her, a contempt for the potential for repercussions, or someone interrupted mid-deed? In Steve Rowland's mind, there's the potential for yet more unexploded ammunition.
There's also a strong suggestion of possible interference after she was dragged there.
Exhibit Q, photos taken of the scene, confirmed the state and arrangement of clothing on what remained of Karen. Elaborated on by Drs. Thompson and Isaac, as well as Sergeant Bayer, who'd eventually rise to the top echelons of the ACT division of the AFP as Assistant Commissioner. She was still wearing her pale blue knitted cardigan, open at the front. At the rear, pulled up beneath the shoulder and the collar region. Down her black, white and mauve patterned dress, three groups of 2 half-inch white buttons extending from the base of the neck to the waist. The lower 2 buttons were done up. In the area of her midriff, both were missing. Of the 2 nearest the throat, the top one was missing, the bottom one unbuttoned. Each of the 3 errant fasteners was located within the immediate arc of the body. 3 possibilities for consideration. Fraying threads, scavenging wildlife and insects, a sign of the natural expansion or bloat stage of decomposition, forcing them to pop. Certainly for Dr. Thompson, this small feature might, though, constitute something of consequence, enough for him to describe their aspect in detail. In addressing such a prospect, Detective Sergeant Reinhardt points out,
"You're looking at photographs, I can't say what buttons are still on. I would rely on the coroner's report, the pathologist's report, the doctor's to say this is what was still buttoned up. Because I know there's issues with buttons popping in terms of the bloating, and some people are concerned that buttons are missing. However, all the buttons were recovered, so we're satisfied that her full dress was there when she was left at the forest, and buttons didn't pop elsewhere."
The somewhat mixed signals, though, continued. Responsible for microscopic examinations of what was left behind, as well as Karen's fingernails, revealing nothing significant, so did Sergeant Bayer make a close inspection of the clothing. Heavily impregnated with body fats, all were deemed in good condition. The sergeant would also state Karen's above-the-knee cotton dress was pulled up about the hips. If dragged across the ground by the arms on her back, it's not illogical to presume the dress would likely have remained down unless otherwise altered or caught on something. If so, in this instance, nothing appeared to be mentioned. Having unexpectedly passed away in 1977, the expression of Dr. Thompson's analysis on this matter is revoiced here.
"The upper part of the sleeveless floral dress was bunched up in front of the chest and upper abdomen. This is to say that the shoulder bands of the dress were not located over the shoulders, thus raising the question as to whether the dress could have been in this position in life. This question cannot be answered with certainty, but the disarticulation of the arm bones, of the shoulder blades, which were distinctly out of position, it must be kept in mind that animal interference could very well account for the finding.
Dr. Isaac detailed that the top half of Karen's dress was folded down and rumpled on top of the corpse, leaving the remains of the thorax exposed, that is, the chest area from the neck to the abdomen. It would also be he who'd theorised that, as no bones were damaged by biting, chewing or gnawing, its visitation upon by large animals was unlikely. Then there was the situation of her undergarments. Along with her largely intact pantyhose, Karen's briefs were in place. It was noted there was a small tear in one of the seams. Again, in likelihood, thread eroding. However, if your imagination strays wildly enough, perhaps the size of a tip of a sharp knife, such a weapon similarly able to cut free a few buttons? Mere speculation. Also, she was wearing a panty girdle.
It smooths you here, it smooths you there, controls you smoothly everywhere. Sarong Body Magic by Burley. Only girdle to fit your waist and your thigh. While it smooths and controls here, Sarong Body Magic adjusts and adjusts and adjusts to every thigh. No bind or bulge anywhere. Choose a girdle or panty. Sarong Body Magic by Burley.
A black and white TV ad from 1968, preserved by the National Film and Sound Archive, promoting the elasticised, hip-hugging garment popular with women from the early 1900s. Embraced as a major advancement from the heavy, restricting corsets of the previous century. Come the more free-flowing 70s, though, not as much in vogue among younger fashionistas. For Dr. Thompson, the disposition of each of the items in which the lower body was clad did not suggest sexual assault. On September 25th, the Sydney Morning Herald, the oldest continually published paper in Australia, according to industry figures in 2020, the most widely read masthead in the country, echoed this sentiment. It rather broadly reported the position of clothing on the skeleton was normal and did not indicate sexual assault. And yet, variations in these matters presented during proceedings introduced more elements of doubt. In charge of the case was the long-serving, dedicated inspector, Reg Kennedy. He'd formally state that, according to the Rowland family, and in particular the parents, Karen was in the habit of consistently wearing her underclothing in a particular manner. If this had been altered in some way, was never resolved beyond doubt. The woman who had befriended Karen during her brief stay in M Ward, the acute care unit of the Canberra Community Hospital, is referred to in this podcast as Maureen. Almost inadvertently, it would come to light that on February 26, Karen's final day alive, she'd apparently taken a shower and changed into one of the loose-fitting dresses that the two of them had bought that day. When posed questions on if Karen had replaced her underwear in a different manner to the way that she normally did, Maureen's recollection appeared hazy. Initially, she'd indicate she didn't think Karen had been wearing a girdle, this altering to her not being sure. Whether she'd known Karen's usual practice or was aware of the order of underwear and clothing subsequently, there was no real clarity. Inspector Kennedy would, though, nominate the state of dress on the finding of the body had been discussed, raising speculative possibilities once more then, seemingly never fully explored, the timing of variations to clothing and stories about it, or other what-if scenarios, including if Karen might even have been redressed after death. When posed to Sergeant Reinhardt,
"It's a very hard question to answer. You could say yes, you could say no. Unfortunately, I can't even guess as to if she was redressed or not. Overall, she was still wearing her clothes when she was placed in the forest."
Amidst all that was constantly evolving and revolving, what appeared the clincher, the more startling revelation, Karen's bra had been missing. In the searches of the scene that ensued, a televised report on the day of Keren's discovery, showing numerous detectives and officials in dark suits and thin ties, tentatively picking through knee-high dried grass and shoveling things into plastic bags. The bra was located. Further off within the pines, beyond where she had, in all probability, been discarded. This aspect certainly made mention of in the media, although minus other pertinent facts, and so, unsurprisingly, long fueling suspicions. Of the nursing or maternity variety, the bra was still partially fastened. Without attempting to categorically declare evidence of something untoward, although distressing, imagine if you will the following, as recorded. The best preserved parts of the body were the forearms and legs where mummification had occurred. Her arms, while detached from the shoulders, the upper parts largely devoid of flesh, the lower consisting of dried skin and muscle, remained within the sleeves of the cardigan she still wore. The bones of what was once her upper torso in disarray, with many detached, those from the neck mixed among the ribs and spinal vertebrae. Specifically, the third to the seventh vertebrae of the spine, essentially the centre of what would have been her back, were disturbed. However, with the exception of a single rib bone around 3 feet away, none of the others were widely removed from their normal location. So was it held that the skull, completely detached from the spine, had not been moved. Her dress was buttoned at the top and around her waist, the chest area apparently at least partially exposed. The bra then, it seems, would have to have been removed through the front opening of the dress. Rather than alongside the body, it was a good few feet away. While the presence of larger animals was discounted, presumably referencing foxes, sleek, sizable ravens, made eternally ominous thanks to Gothic writer Edgar Allan Poe, are very common to that location. Would such a bird have been able to successfully manoeuvre the double-cupped piece of material? The experts would formally reveal the bra was heavily impregnated with body fats, indicating that it had been removed after decomposition had reached an advanced state. For the investigators, its relocation almost definitely attributable to animal activity of some kind. Detective Sergeant Reinhardt is dismissive of any suggestion otherwise.
I would strongly disagree suggesting that bra indicates anything. Yeah, that's a red herring to suggest that, okay. Because the bra was off. I mean, she was assaulted. Yeah, looking at the pathologist's report that leaves it in no uncertain terms that was on there for quite a period of decomposition.
And the raven's eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming. What this grim, ungainly, ghastly, gaunt and ominous bird of yore meant in croaking, nevermore.
On a detailed scouring of the known, albeit limited record, it's a challenge to find a published reference to the possibility that Keren had indeed been subjected to some kind of sexual attack. That changed with the 1996 conviction of serial killer Ivan Milat. One who'd come to hold a strong position on Keren's case and who'd subsequently put it in writing that she had been raped and her body covered with pine branches was Clive Small, Chief of Task Force Air, responsible for the arrest of the man dubbed the Backpacker Murderer. On page 164 of his 2014 book, Milat, Inside Australia's Biggest Manhunt, A Detective Story, Mr. Small also postulates, the cause of death could not be conclusively established, although it appeared she had been strangled. So has the former head detective received much attention for his suggestion that Keren Rowland may have been Milat's first trial run victim. Definitive support and evidence for that proposition remains elusive. The detail on these aspects are all explored further in Case File Fragments 3, Spectre of a Canberra Serial Killer, in this Capital Crime Files podcast season. Others more intimately involved in the case vary in their opinions. The police officer to the coroner's court, present both at the air disaster memorial site after Kerrin was found and who assisted in the autopsy proceedings, is another who holds that whatever happened to her, it wasn't sexually motivated. The AFP's Adam Reinhardt is not quite so clear-cut, giving voice to more baffling questions of potential motive.
Well, we know there's no robbery because all the possessions were still there. Sexual assault, maybe not. That definitely makes it really weird as to why Kerrin was picked, why Kerrin ended up where she did. The main reasons that you would expect, if they don't exist, then that certainly makes it bizarre.
Although far from the final word, Steve Rowland, while not entirely convinced either way, ruefully makes the connection that, in likelihood, his sister was subjected to an act of sexual violence.
Yeah, pretty good chance she was sexually assaulted.
Yet one more curiosity, considered important enough to be made mention of at the time of the inquest and which, with hindsight, has subsequently loomed much larger. Brought to the attention of the court almost as an aside by Dr. Isaac. He having also unexpectedly passed away at 68 in 1976, the year before Dr. Thompson. His voice is recreated here for these purposes.
The only other abnormal finding made by me in the area was an empty brown-coloured 26-ounce beer bottle which lay equidistant from the right sandal and the handbag, some 5 feet away to the right of the line of articles.
Still to come in Capital Crime Files Season 1.
It's important that we recognise that the air disaster memorial, that wasn't the only thing that ever occurred in that pine plantation. Lots of sort of bizarre behaviour was happening in that pine forest at the time. So it was a busy little area way back then.
With thanks to radio station 1206 2CC, Canberra City News and voiceovers and assistance from Rod Henshaw, Josh Hazer and Brent Ford, other voiceover contributions from Jack Morrish, audio mastering by Steve Forrest, original music Ed Reading, production assistance from Sam Worry and Beck Rose. If anyone has any information or anything that might relate, please reach out at capitalcrimefiles.com.au. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.